On the afternoon of May 16, 1894, the Ladies' Sketch Club of San Francisco gathered in the auditorium of Stockwell's Theater in eager anticipation. Local artist Solly Walter had agreed to deliver a lecture on artistic anatomy, explaining the musculature of the human body and its representation in ancient sculptures, Renaissance paintings, and in the women's own artistic enterprises. To illustrate his lecture, though, he chose not plaster casts nor lantern slides, but rather a living, breathing human, Eugen Sandow, popularly known in his day as the perfect man, seen here. Yet Mr. Walter was quick to advise his audience on the nature of their subject. Quote, "Although it seems peculiar to explain a human body to you as if it were a statue, it is to be looked upon as a work of art and not as being alive at all." End quote. Sandow was thus transformed into an object of study, an inanimate it rather than a living he. Whoops, I went too far. In the ensuing controversy, some headlines of which you see here, when the Society for the Suppression of Vice and other objectors complained of the indecency of an audience of women viewing Sandow's living body, lambasted the Ladies' Sketch Club for organizing the event and called for police intervention in numerous editorials, this metamorphosis of living, scandalous flesh into cold marble was again invoked in the women's defense. As one such defending editorial said, quote, "The ladies never for a moment thought about Sandow being a man. He was used merely as an illustration and gave everyone the effect that a marble statue would have done," end quote. Metaphors of sculpture pervaded Sandow's public image. His very medium was his body, which he molded and sculpted through exercise into a statuesque form that could serve as the embodiment of classical ideals, one that might allay contemporary concerns about the modern world's impact upon physical and mental health. Many scholars, including John Kasson's incisive analysis of Sandow in his Houdini, Tarzan, and the Perfect Man, have discussed Sandow's popularity in terms of its appeal as a sign of strength and vitality to predominantly white audiences who are thought to be experiencing that epidemic of neurasthenia due to the exponentially increasing divide between physical laborers and so-called brain workers who lived in urban centers that were undergoing rapid demographic changes with migration and immigration. Sandow provided a reassuring example of the strength and virility of white men, and in particular, white gentlemen. The very display of this body also raised concerns, though, that required a delicate mediation, elevating the body to a work of art. As with many bodybuilders of the period, Sandow frequently made allusions to Greco-Roman sculpture and classical culture to mitigate the display of his nearly naked body and to add an aura of refinement to his performances and circulated image. Yet these mediations, I argue, often have an undercurrent of violence to them. They petrify Sandow, transforming him from a living human being, to a lifeless sculpture. In collaboration with photographers, filmmakers, sculptors, and medical experts, Sandow transformed his image in ways that reveal a canny medium specificity, an engagement with issues of temporality, animation and petrification, life and death. Sandow was a native of Königsberg, Prussia, today Kaliningrad, and he came to international attention in 1889, when, at the age of 22, he defeated the then world's strongest man at a showy performance in London. Yet Sandow was at pains to distance himself from the seamy world of sideshows, strongman contests, and vaudeville, where he had first gained fame, and you see some headlines of that here. Instead, he aspired to project an image of refinement and cultivation, and so he adopted the canny strategy of courting both artists and physicians to insinuate himself into their worlds of culture and education. Part of this was Sandow's media machine, which capitalized on recent innovations in printing technologies and photomechanical reproduction, spreading his image and fame quickly through photographs, cabinet cards, and illustrations in popular journals, priming the pump, as it were, for his coming performances in different cities. And as part of the tactic on his 1893 tour of the United States, Sandow, he performed in several different cities, including New York, Boston, San Francisco, here in Philadelphia, and other places, most extensively in Chicago, which was a city newly endowed with the neoclassical trappings of the Columbian Exposition. But before starting performances in a new town, Standout would arrange private shows with physicians and artists, inviting them to examine his anatomy, as it were. Of course, the press was also invited, handily enough, on hand to record the doctors' and artists' exclamations over his perfect form. And the headline we're looking at here, and these images are from a later newspaper, but they get at the similar issues in 1893, and I'll read you some quotes from those 1893 kind of press previews, as they were. For example, quote, in New York, yesterday a surprising and immensely interesting private introduction to Mr. Standout and his muscles entertained a specially invited party of artists, sculptors, scientists, physicians, and athletes. Physicians pronounce him a marvel of physical development, and he should be seen by all admirers of perfect form, end quote. Another example of New York entertainments told of 4,000 professional men from the surrounding area, including Philadelphia College of Physicians, surgeons and doctors who came to examine Sandow's body in advance. They were given 4 weeks to examine Sandow's body. Different groups went each week, and at the end of it, they supposedly had a conference and compared notes about his body. I have yet to see the collected papers from that conference, but I'm sure it's in an archive somewhere. But these previews had their intended effect. As the New York Times noted, quote, scarcely ever, never has a more heterogeneous audience been seen within the walls of one of our city theaters than that which crowds the casino at 10:30 o'clock nightly for the Sandow Show. The well-known professor of anatomy, the art student, the celebrated doctor, the man about town, and the worshiper at the shrine of pugilism jostle each other in their rush to the box office. In addition to these publicity stunts, Standow produced a public image that emphasized the important role that classical antiquity played in his development, repeatedly telling interviewers of a trip he took to Italy as a young boy, where he was struck by the seeming strength and beauty of classical sculptures, and thus decided to take up exercise and perfect his own form. As he informed a Chicago interviewer speaking of his travels in Italy, quote, in the art galleries, I found the model I desired to copy. Day after day, I visited the model, each time studying a new muscle or a new bump. Before long, I had photographed that statue so firmly on my mind that I could bring it before my gaze at will, and it was my only trainer during my hours of exercise, end quote. Standow thereby reassured audiences that they would not be ogling a titillating display of flesh, but rather a carefully crafted copy of a classical sculpture, molded through exercise, rather than with a copyist's chisels or the molds of a plaster cast. This metaphor that Standow utilized reversed the trope of a living human serving as the model for a finished sculpture of marble or clay. Instead, Standow's model was the lifeless ancient sculpture, his own body, the finished work of art. Rather than art imitating life, in this case, the living Standow imitated art. A reporter for the Boston Globe encouraged viewers to compare Standow's body with the stone original, when he handily helped with that comparison by posing as the Farnese Hercules himself. As the author from the Boston Globe reported, quote, Standow determined to make himself look as much like a statue of a Greek god as possible, and succeeded as an eminent degree, as can be seen by comparing his photograph with that of the Farnese Hercules, end quote. So Standow helped us all to compare his form by participating in this tradition of tableau vivant, or living pictures. These photographic tropes and traditions were even more directly engaged by the selection of the dying gladiator motif, one that explicitly raises the frequent associations of photography and death. Standow's enactment of the pose here activates a rich tension between animation and petrification, especially when considered in light of the tradition of tableau vivant and the dying gladiator as he performed it for the first issue of photographer Napoleon Serigny's monthly publication, Living Pictures, a journal that updated the popular practice of the tableau vivant by employing models, usually celebrities, to stage scenes either from theater or from famous works of art. Serrani's photographs were translated into an early version of multicolored photomechanical reproductions. And this portfolio is held at the library at Princeton. The photographs were printed on a warm ivory peach colored ground, which gives the suggestion of living flesh tones rather than the stark white of marble. Yet the teal ink used to print the photographs cancels out the warm tones on Sandow's body, creating a dissonance between the notion of living pictures and the possibility of the blood draining from the skin of a dying gladiator. Sandow's choice of this dying Gaul or dying gladiator trope evokes not only ideas of heroism and noble sacrifice, but also engages that friction between life and death, animate human and inanimate sculpture. And we seem to be missing images. When we tested them before, they were all here, but like I said, perfection and imperfection, they happen sometimes. But Sandow's transformation into sculpture was made complete in 1901, when the British Museum of Natural History invited him to pose for a plaster cast meant to represent a specimen of European man, a process that literally translated Sandow's body into a statue, petrified for posterity. And I'll see. We'll come back to that. The cast was commissioned from the plaster craftsman Bruciani and Company, probably best known for their production of casts for the Victoria and Albert Museum's famed cast court. And I think some of the casts in the other room are also by the Bruciani Company. But they also had a standing contract with also the other South Kensington Museum, the Natural History Museum. So they created casts of both sculptural and architectural and fossil and skeleton works. But today's viewers, the sculpture, if we can ever find it. So we can kind of see from this fuzzy microfilm copy, this is an image of the final cast as it came about. But to today's viewers, the cast forms this awkward amalgamation of eras and references. There's that superimposed fig leaf, which suggests a Victorian whitewashing of classical sculpture. There's the inclusion of Sandow's trademark telltale mustache, which is odd to us now, indicating his status as a fashionable turn-of-the-century gentleman. The pose, presumably adapted from photographs and stage performances, it's still not there. That's crazy. But he did do this pose. And you can vaguely, well, I'll trust your imagination to fill in the details of this egregious microfilm scan. But despite its awkwardness, at the time, Sandow and the British Museum were really proud of this cast. They compared it favorably to sculptures from antiquity. Sandow and Ray Lankester, British Museum director and keeper of zoology who had commissioned the cast, repeatedly emphasized the truthfulness of plaster, a medium that recorded things as they were, without the powers of artistic idealization, creating an indexical sign, a physical trace of Sandow's own body. And as so many before him had done, Lankester also compared Sandow's body to classical sculpture, proclaiming the authenticity of the plaster cast at representing musculature and human achievement. And I'll give a somewhat long quote from Lankester about Sandow's body as it compared, or Sandow, the cast of Sandow's body, rather, as it compared to sculptures. Quote, "A good many people are fond of insisting that the mighty men of muscle, which were portrayed in marble by the sculptors of the classical age, were simply products of the sculptor's imagination, fancy presentments of men as they might be, rather than of any who actually existed. But here we have a cast of a man who lives and breathes at this very moment, which comes favorably out of a comparison with any of them." Some of you might disagree. But the actual mold of the living figure, which must be correct in every detail. In the times to come, this will show the world that such men as the great sculptors portrayed have most indubitably existed in the flesh." End quote. And here I want to return to Sandow's posing as an art model and how he tried to distinguish himself from other art models, usually the bodies of laborers, as seen here in these images, some of which are also shown across the street. But Sandow, on the other hand, instead of these laboring bodies that were usually posed, Sandow professed to provide a model like the sculptures of antiquity, an ideal form in the flesh, providing a model for figure study distinct from what some saw as ugly realism. When Sandow posed for the ladies, San Francisco Ladies Sketch Club, artist Solly Walter proposed Sandow as an alternative, embodying a well-proportioned form, the body as it should be. As Solly Walter explained in his lecture, quote, the modern sculptor, has to piece a statue together, take an arm here, a torso there, because he cannot find the perfect representation of a human being without doing so. Today, I'm sorry to say, a degeneration has taken place in art, which is called realism. If it were true realism, it would be all right. But when the artist finds his models lacking, he reproduces the ugly, the nasty, and the imperfect, calling it realism. I wish to show that the realistic impersonation of the ugly instead of the beautiful is wrong. Mr. Sandow has kindly permitted me to use him to demonstrate that the ideal of Michelangelo is not an exaggeration, that the Venus of Milo and the Farnesian Hercules are not merely ideals that have been pieced together, but that their perfections must have existed in one model. End quote. The rhetoric of artistic idealization based upon virtual dismemberment and bricolage was also invoked by Dudley Allen Sargent, the famed physical education director at Harvard. And here's another somewhat long quote from him. Quote, for the famous statue of the gladiators in the Boston Museum of Fine Arts, he said, probably 20 athletes of Rome were called upon to pose. That statue represents the nearest to perfection that the Romans were able to get. The athlete who had the best arm furnished that portion, another man probably posed for the legs, still another for the torso, or portions thereof, and so on. Then probably the most famous wrestler contributed a cast of his neck, all this surmounted by a head copied from a man whose body might have been deficient in many particulars. Yet we cannot deny that consummate skill was used in putting these various parts in place, and then putting the completed gladiators in action. These figures, having been built up from various portions of the highest types of development known to the ancient Romans, resulted in that magnificent statue. Yet our cast, taken from one form, Sandow's body, is nearer to the ideal type than anything the world has ever before known. And again, some of you might disagree with that assessment. Its beauty and symmetry, embodying as it does the most magnificent story of human achievement in the line of physical development, will be in this generation and the generation that shall follow a constant inspiration to young men. So thus, Sandow is seen as embodying in one form all of the perfect, the ideal. But these passages also point to an unsettling dismemberment required to make an ideal sculpture. And Sandow's body also circulated in pieces, actually. Shortly after beginning work on the cast, Sandow had triumphantly announced the commission and, in time for Christmas, was advertising what you see here at the top, a supposedly, quote, magnificent ornament for a study or an athlete's den. Mr. Sandow has often been urged by artists and sculptors to have a cast taken of his superb limbs. This has at last been accomplished. Casts have been made of that portion, including the forearm, upper arm and shoulder actual size, since it's a cast, mounted on a crimson plush shield, forming an ornament of absolutely unique character, undoubtedly. He also included a life-size photograph of his arm that was a fold-out in his volume, The Gospel of Strength. And so these life-size photographs and mounted casts provide a means for far-flung audiences to experience the scale of Sandow's body, marveling at his muscles and comparing their own forms to his at close range. When New Zealand Gymnasium, oh yes, installed a cast proudly labeled Sandow's arm, providing yet another impetus for their clients to achieve a form like Sandow's. And unfortunately, it doesn't seem to have the crimson plush shield that that kind of trophy mount advertised does, but they're still doing pretty well. And later, these plaster casts of Sandow's arm were also available for sale from the Boston-based plaster cast firm of P.P. Caproni and Brother, who primarily sold casts as subjects for art schools. And actually, the cover image from the catalog is a Caproni cast, the Oudin et Crochet. And you can see it in their page. Oh, trigger. There we go. These acts of virtual dismemberment and dissection were taken even further when Sandow published an écorché version of the cast for a series he called Artistic Anatomy, again, ostensibly intended to teach readers about anatomy. And this image is from a really rare, it's very hard to find, Sandow's magazine, the US version, and this is from the College of Physicians here in Philadelphia. As Sandow informed his readers, quote, "We are enabled to show from the muscles themselves the exact position on the surface, what their uses are, how to develop them, and what results can be secured. It is with this that this series of articles will deal, not from the sculptor's imaginative standpoint, but from the actual muscles," end quote. And the series of articles that Sandow referred to was intended to be a treatise on anatomy, using illustrations of Sandow's body to delineate the muscles of the human body. Yet the primary illustration that you see here was a drawing based upon the Sandow cast, complete with its shallow pedestal. And you can see the sculpted forms of his hair there. For instructional purposes, the muscles are striated to suggest muscle fibers, an effect that evokes anatomy atlases with their depictions of flayed cadavers. Yet Sandow's cast has no skin, no muscle fiber, and so Sandow's body is therefore doubly displaced, transforming from a living, breathing body to a sculpture, yet a sculpture that then is flayed and dissected. Furthermore, its representation in the magazine is mediated by several further degrees. Rather than teaching from actual muscles, as he said he intended to do, the reader instead views an illustration based upon the cast, which is itself only an image of Sandow's body. This was not the first time that Sandow had used images of his own body to illustrate the principles of human anatomy. A series in the UK version of Sandow's magazine, which hopefully we'll see, also entitled Artistic Anatomy, yes, included photographs of Sandow in his popular poses, yet diagrammed and labeled to show muscle fibers, images that are, I think, really uneasily violent. And these were done by, so you can see in this image, this is based on this Warwick Brooks photograph, whereas his ridiculous pose with the leopard skin trunks and the column is based on this Warwick Brooks photograph. And these images, the altered photographs, were done by Robert J. Colenso, who was a British physician and anatomy instructor, who made similarly creepy images for a book called Living Anatomy. And then this book, it also includes photographs next to photographs that have been altered to show the muscle striations, but these are with kind of generic people, and usually their heads are turned away. It's not a celebrity, an identifiable human being that's been stripped of skin and diagrammed. Although Sandow's face is left untouched and still recognizable, and his props, including a fig leaf, which we saw in the earlier one where he's sitting there, so that fig leaf remains intact, the overlay drawings suggest that he's been flayed alive to reveal the muscle fibers beneath the skin. One viewer of one of Sandow's stage performances had marveled at his defined musculature and how rare it was by remarking, quote, "In configuration, his body looked like that of a man with the skin and membranes removed, leaving only the muscular anatomy revealed," end quote. These altered photographs literalized the suggestion, presenting a flayed Sandow stripped of his skin in the way that was usually confined to anonymous cadavers dissected for medical or anatomical study. And this analogy was taken a step further, actually, when Sandow was himself portrayed as an anatomical mannequin for his 1907 book, The Construction and Reconstruction of the Human Body. And here again, you see Sandow in his handy gladiator sandals and leopard print trunks. And then he opens up to show muscles and skeletons. And if you look closely, you can still see his hair, the outline of his hair, and that crazy mustache. And this is somewhere between a paper doll and a pop-up book. It's a normal-sized book. It's much smaller than the mannequin next door. But it unfolds to reveal a representation of Sandow. You see the skeleton, the muscular structure, the circulatory system, and then those organs, all of which unfold and spill out for maximum accuracy. And you can see here, oh yes, you can play doctor with Sandow. Examine his kidneys. All of these structures are numbered to correspond to a key that you saw, I think, in an earlier image in the background there, so that you can identify all of your body parts, or Sandow's body parts, as it were. And Sandow, of course, was not the first to use this kind of imaging technology. Paper mannequins and three-dimensional models had been in use for centuries as teaching tools for instruction in anatomy and medicine. And this is a pretty advanced technology with double-sided printing, the kind of technology needed to cut and reassemble all of these modes. But Sandow's mannequin is perhaps unique, I think, in basing its form on a specific identified person, rather than an anonymous cadaver or idealized non-specific human like you had here. Instead, Sandow's distinctive profile with his telltale mustache is printed even on the plates that supposedly represent his organs and viscera. Readers were thus invited to analyze and dissect the interior of Sandow's body in a virtual vivisection of sorts. All these iterations of artistic anatomy, designed to present Sandow as an educated, refined mind and body, one that would be a resource for artists and doctors, as well as the general public. But Sandow's body offered both an embodied ideal, one of wholeness and coherence, and one of analytical fragmentation and dismemberment, an uneasy mixture of celebrity, individual, ideal sculpture, and medical specimen. The living, perfect man, and the cadaver all at the same time. Thank you.